Welcome to Small World, Big Problems, a podcast from the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies in Washington, D.C. My name is Milos Maggiore, and today I will be interviewing Deputy Ambassador of the EU to the U.S., Michael Curtis, on the state of the Transatlantic Alliance in the face of international security crises. The EU and the U.S. have been steadfast partners for the past 70 years, with a healthy trading relationship and close cooperation on global issues such as climate change, rule of law, emerging technologies, and international security. As the war in Ukraine rages on, the evolving situation in Gaza has brought attention back to the Middle East, in which humanitarian concerns in the Gaza Strip run in parallel with concerns of the conflict spreading further across the region. The Transatlantic Alliance has been strong in confronting both challenges. However, in a year of elections on both sides of the Atlantic, it should not always be taken for granted. At the time of recording this podcast, on February 15th, 2024, the $60 billion aid package to Ukraine from the US is still being held up in Congress, and upcoming US elections in November are once again raising questions of the extent of the country's commitment to transatlantic security. Against all this has been the growing belligerent stance from China in the Taiwan Strait, and the concern of its relationship with Russia, both amongst the reasons for which the EU and US have decided to reduce their dependency on China in trade, whilst preparing for the eventuality that tensions may rise further. On today's episode, I will be discussing all of these issues with Deputy Ambassador Curtis, to get a perspective of the state of affairs for a European diplomat in the United States. Before his posting in DC in 2019, Deputy Ambassador Curtis served in the team of the EU Commissioner for Development and Humanitarian Aid, and represented the EU in the United Nations as Humanitarian Affairs Counselor. He was closely involved in setting up the European External Action Service in 2010, and was an advisor to the EU's Foreign Policy High Representative Federica Mogherini, advising her on a number of foreign policy issues, including on transatlantic relations. We hope you enjoy this episode of Small World, Big Problems. Deputy Ambassador Curtis, thank you again for taking the time to be on our show today.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, before we get into the topics of international security, I was wondering if you could go a bit into your background, talk us through what led to the decision to want to work for the EU and to represent it abroad.
Well, thanks for the question. It takes me back to when I was a student studying French and politics at University of Leicester in the UK, where I developed an interest for the European Union. This was in the late 80s. I did then a master's at the College of Europe in Bruges, which really left a lasting impression on me. And I quickly, soon after that, I joined the European institutions. I worked for the European Commission for about 26 years, mainly in external relations. I had a stint as a spokesperson for the Commission on Development and Humanitarian Aid. I worked in our delegation to the United Nations in New York, mainly always on like trade, external relations, development, humanitarian issues. And that basically in 2014 took me to the cabinet, the team of the then High Representative Vice President Federica Mogherini. I worked for her for 5 years and working on transatlantic relations, which brought me here to Washington, D.C. in 2019 as Deputy Ambassador of the European Union to the United States. You can tell from my accent, I'm British, but I'm a dual national. I'm also Italian, very, very, very proud to have that as well. So, I mean, I always wanted to work a bit for what I felt was the greater good in some ways, beyond working for a member state who I, you know, completely respect, and many of my friends are member state diplomats. I was always been motivated to work for the more common European interest, and always found it very motivating that the European Union has been seen as a force for good in the world, for peace and for development, also for climate change. So that's why I'm very happy to be helping to represent the European Union, which is in our biggest bilateral relationship in the world with the United States.
Can you give us a sense on what it is like to represent the EU specifically in the United States as perhaps one of the longest partners of the EU for the past 70 years? How does the EU decision-making process affect your job, and how does the US perhaps differ from other countries?
Well, you know, I mentioned it's one of our largest delegations. That's because we have, as well as colleagues like myself from the European External Action Service, we have like 17 commission departments represented here, which basically shows the breadth and depth of the relationship the EU has with the United States. I mean, we cover climate, energy, trade, foreign policy, research, health. I mean, you name it. I think there's not a single European policy which isn't covered by our relationship with the United States. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of focus on foreign policy, working together with the United States on bilateral issues, which, you know, for example, like Ukraine, which we'll talk about a little bit more. But also, you know, we have competence, the European Commission for Trade Relations on behalf of the European Union and the member states. So that's a large part of our work. Obviously, you know, we adapt to a little bit what the global situation is. Of course, we've been working a lot on energy and climate, energy partly also as a consequence of Russia's illegal invasion of Ukraine as well. So it's that means there's a lot of ground to cover. Another part of my job is coordination with the 27 member states. All the member states, of course, are present here with their own embassies in Washington, D.C. And I think for many of them, you know, they would count their bilateral relationship with the U.S. as being also among, if not the most important, of their bilateral relationships as well. So we have a lot of work to do with the member states, showing European unity's diversity, but also its unity. And a lot of the strength that we have and the work we do with the Americans is a reflection of the fact that we are speaking also on behalf of 27 member states on some of the issues like trade I mentioned. So definitely the EU-US relationship over the years has had some ups and downs. I think that's sort of natural in any relationship. But, you know, it's still very much in so many terms, in trade, economics, investment, security, defense, you name it. It you know, when the EU and US work together, it makes a difference, I think globally. And I think, for example, we've certainly seen that happen on Ukraine, for example.
And just circling back to what you said about coordinating with the member states as well, does that ever become a major challenge in being able to represent the EU to the United States, having to also manage the bilateral relationships with the member states?
Generally, it's very smooth. I think it works a lot better than people do imagine. The actual policy making is decided in Brussels, so we're not actually deciding on the policy here. But of course, we input into what that policy should look like, and also how to articulate that and advocate for that with an American audience as well. I think it's important in this respect to point out that our work in the US goes beyond the administration. It goes beyond Congress and sort of the Washington Beltway. We also, of course, cover the whole geographic scope of the United States. Very, very large country, very diverse country. So a lot of our work as well is doing outreach, and some of that outreach we do as an EU delegation on our own, but also a lot of that we do with our member states as well. For example, I travel with the other deputy ambassadors around the US. We do try to do a trip at least once a year. The trade councillors do that. Human rights councillors also do that. So there's a lot to be done. You also asked about the decision making. I say that is made in Brussels. The European Commission's the executive, which makes the proposals, and we have the Council and the Parliament, who are the co-legislators. This is when we're making legislation. But on policy, a lot of in the foreign policy area is decided by the member states in the Foreign Affairs Council. They adopt council conclusions, and that's also a guide for our work. It's in some ways a little bit our marching orders for what we do here. We're working as the EU delegation under the responsibility of the High Representative Vice President, who's Josep Borrell. But, you know, we take our guidance also from the European Council, which, you know, is the ultimate decision-making body in the EU, but also working very closely with the European Commission and its leadership. And just last October, we had the presidents of the European Council, Charles Michel, and of the Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, who were here in October for the EU-US summit.
it seems to me that discussing EU decision making could take a whole episode in and of itself.
I want to keep your readers, your listeners rather, keep the listeners awake. I can always get a bit more granular if you want, but maybe there are other you'd like to discuss.
Well, let's move on to perhaps the elephant in the room in terms of European security, which is the ongoing conflict in Ukraine, which has been going on for the past 2 years at this point. And both the EU and the US have had their own struggles being able to provide military and financial assistance to Ukraine, despite generally having popular support in both camps. In your experience working here, what have been some of the differences that you have seen in terms of how the respective camps have approached these challenges?
Well, I will answer your question. You know, you ask about some of the differences and some of the challenges, but what I have to say is that we have worked so closely and quickly together with the Americans since the beginning of the conflict, since even actually before the conflict. We've worked very quickly on sanctions together. I mean, the European Union itself passed 12 rounds of sanctions, but we worked very closely and very quickly with the Americans on this. We've also, you know, been very clear in our political and diplomatic outreach about where we stand on this. And of course, we've also coordinated a lot on the sort of assistance that we're giving. I mean, we have adopted last week an extra $54 billion assistance package for Ukraine, but which has got a lot of attention here, especially given what's going on in the Congress. But we shouldn't forget that before that, we've already given $96 billion in aid to Ukraine. About $30 billion of that has been in military support, which for us has been the first time that the European Union has actually given, you know, military lethal weaponry to Ukraine. And of course, there was the historic decision of the European Council in December to open accession negotiations with Ukraine, which is, you know, let's not forget, a country at war. And I think that's a testament to the determination that we have as the EU to do that. I think what's united us is the challenge is clear. You know, Russia's aggression is aimed at Ukraine. It's a democratic country which has the right under the UN Charter to choose its own future. It's also an attack on European, not just on Ukrainian security, and you know they're paying the price every day, but also on European security and our values more broadly. And this is something which I think resonates a lot in the US. I think, you know, Secretary Blinken has said that the EU is the US's partner of first resort, and I would agree with that. I think, you know, the way we've worked together has been a demonstration of the importance of the relationship. I say we've been in, we were in contact, close contact before the invasion, trying to deter Russia. That didn't work, but we've tried to make Russia pay the price. We've also tried to support Ukraine. I've mentioned, you know, in terms of military aid and humanitarian aid, but also keeping its infrastructure running as well. And this has all been collective and complementary between the Americans and the Europeans. Now, in which way has our aid, our support differed? I think in some ways, you know, we have given military aid as EU for the first time, but the Americans are giving more military aid than us. I think they've given about $44 billion compared to our $30 billion. We've had perhaps placed more emphasis on providing budgetary support, what we call macro financial assistance to Ukraine. But also our situations are a little bit different. We're united and committed in defending the values and security. But, you know, in Europe, we're closer to the conflict. We've taken in, I think, about 4 million Ukrainians are registered for a program, the temporary protection mechanism in Europe. We've decoupled from Russian fossil fuels very, very quickly. And of course, you know, this has had a perhaps more of an impact on the European economy than it would have had on the American economy. So, you know, we've worked very sort of closely with the Americans in that respect. There's been our sanctions have also been coordinated. Now, we've not exactly sanctioned all the same people and all the same companies and all the same areas, but we've actually worked in a way that are actually complementary to one another. So I don't think there's really any daylight in the way we've approached. Of course, now there is the issue here of the US trying to pass a supplemental bill for support for Ukraine, which is, of course, something we follow very carefully, and we hope that that support will come through. I mean, it is crucial because I think EU's gone on the record saying that we can't substitute for a lot of that military assistance that the Americans have given. So, you know, it's been a large part of our work here in Washington, D.C. A lot of it's been explaining what the European Union is doing, spending a lot of time on the Hill in Congress doing that, reaching out to different sections of the American society. And, you know, I think that's been appreciated, but it's a constant message that we have to pass.
Yeah, and on top of the package that is currently held up in Congress, 2024 is probably going to be quite an interesting year due to all the elections that are going to be happening on both sides of the Atlantic. You've got the European elections in June, and then you've got, obviously, the US general election in November. If we can project a little bit, how do you see these elections impacting the future of EU defence or transatlantic defence?
It depends a little bit, I suppose, on the outcome of the elections. You mentioned, you know, we're very much focused, of course, on the elections here in the US, which isn't, let's not forget, just for the White House, it's also for both houses of for the Senate and for the House in Congress. And also in many European member states, there's going to be elections as well. I think, you know, as I said, over the years, the EU-US relationship has evolved, but it's always been very, very strong. We are united by so many issues. If it's not just our values, it's also the trade and economic partnership that we have. It's also working together in various fora, multilateral fora, working on issues like development and climate change as well. And it's clear that we are ready to work with either side, any US administration. The relationship is basically too important for that, and it does transcend political parties and affiliations. And I would also add that the relationship we have with the US, you know, is of course the relationship with whoever's in the White House is very important. But, you know, it's a relationship between our businesses as well. And it goes beyond what we do here in Washington, D.C. We have worked on a lot of issues with, for example, the states and large U.S. cities on issues like climate change, for example, as well. So, you know, sometimes there is a tendency to sort of like reduce the relationship to who is just in the White House. And, of course, wouldn't deny that that's very important. But there is, I would say, a lot more to that. And we need to not lose that perspective.
So comments such as the ones made by the former president a couple of days ago are not as worrying as we should make them out to be?
Well, you know, I think we can never be complacent about transatlantic security. And I think words are very important, you know, when we talk about security, you know, because deterrence is also linked to that. I mean, we say we are in an election campaign. A lot of things do get said and done, but you know, we'll have to work with whoever the American people decide to elect.
Right. I'd like to move on to probably the second largest, or at this point, probably the largest topic of international security that is being talked about here in Washington, which is the situation in the Middle East. Now, obviously, the EU has always been a top deliverer of aid to Gaza. But looking at the news, there's been a sort of demonstrated division amongst the member states of the EU as to the engagement with both Palestine and Israel. And, I mean, we can see this with the votes at the resolution at the UN a couple of months ago. And I think Josep Borrell came on record a couple of weeks ago announcing a new naval mission to the Red Sea in light of the recent attack by the Houthis. I guess, how has the EU managed the relationship that it has with delivering aid to Gaza without completely severing ties with Israel? And how has that impacted the relationship that the EU has with the United States?
Yeah, I think it's important to start, you know, that we have, you know, that although I wouldn't deny that there have been some divisions or differences amongst member states on this issue, and there were before October 7th. I think it's important to underline that we have condemned in the strongest terms, the October 7 attacks by Hamas terrorists against Israel and its citizens, and in fact citizens from other countries, absolutely horrific and no justification. And like the US, European Union also supports, fully supports Israel's right to defend itself in line with international law and international humanitarian law. We've also continued to call for the release of hostages to be released immediately. But also, you know, we also need to, protection of civilians in conflict is also something which is important as well. We're very concerned about, as the Americans are, about the conflict spreading. You know, it does have regional aspects to it. You know, the border between Lebanon and Israel and Iraq and Syria. And you've also mentioned the Houthis as well in the Red Sea. You know, we're concerned, also very concerned about the humanitarian situation in Gaza as well, and making sure that the people who need access to food, medicine and shelter do get that. I think there have been some, as you say, different votes in the United Nations. But I think, you know, again, there is a tendency to focus on what divides us. But, you know, there is also, I think, in what I've set out, also a lot which unites us as well when it comes to what's going on. We've definitely been also very active in diplomatically as well, engaging with Israel, the Palestinians, and also countries in the region. A lot of them were present at the January Foreign Affairs Council, where we were trying to make an effort to do that. Of course, now we're focused on hoping that there would be an extended humanitarian pause in Gaza, that the hostages are released, and that may, of course, then lead to a more a step towards ending the conflict and a more permanent pause in operations as well. Because, as I said, the humanitarian situation is really in a very bad way. Josep Borrell, the HRVP, has been also presented a number of conditions which he thinks is necessary to successfully trying to help resolve this situation. That's, you know, yes to a return of the reinvigorated Palestinian Authority in Gaza, stronger involvement of the countries in the region, and also a greater involvement of the European Union in the regions, particularly in helping build a Palestinian state. You know, but of course, there are issues which have to be resolved. The hostages do have to be released, and we have to try and find a way through this conflict. We have a lot of high-level visitors from Brussels who are engaging with the US administration in talks and about how to address these different issues. So it's very much something along with Ukraine, which is keeping us very much occupied at the moment. We are probably in a few days going to launch a common security and defense policy operation in the Red Sea to protect maritime shipping. That needs to still the final sign off from the foreign ministers, but expectation is that it's going to come sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm. And just quickly circling back to something you said at the very beginning about the EU's normative and value-driven power, is this a situation in which the EU can leverage that influence on the situation?
I think there are probably some limits to do that when you have a hot military conflict underway, but you know, in the end, there's going to have to be a solution to this, and that's normally a diplomatic solution. So we certainly can leverage that. It's working together with countries in the region. It's working together with the United States, but also, of course, with Israel as well, to try and find a way through. I mean, there's a lot of understanding for the trauma and the horror that Israel and Israeli society has suffered. At the same time, you know, it's I think it's there's an onus on international partners to try and find a way through, which means that the suffering is limited to the maximum extent possible.
Mm-hmm. I finally wanted to pick your brains about the third point of the international security trifecta, which often gets mentioned, which would be the situation in the Indo-Pacific and perhaps China's rising stance on the world stage, and in particular how it has approached Taiwan, who recently had an election, and the South China Sea, in which the United States and its allies are still performing freedom of navigation operations. And it seems to me that the EU has typically taken a softer stance than even the Biden administration with regards to China. Yet we do see that the EU has taken a number of steps to move forward with its plans to de-risk from China's economy, as well as updating its maritime security strategy in the Indo-Pacific. Yet it still seems to me that the EU could risk becoming caught in between this great power competition between the US and China, the US obviously being a long-standing partner, and China having a very integrated economy with the EU that is quite hard to step away from. To that end, how do you see the EU being able to utilize its diplomatic approaches to maintain relations with both camps without having to necessarily choose?
Yeah, I think, you know, the EU has certainly recognized in recent years the challenge from China has changed and that our response needs to adapt accordingly. I also think in some ways the US has changed position. You mentioned de-risking, which is something which President von der Leyen, I think, was the first one to mention. And the Americans have adopted that rather than decoupling their own policy and their own discourse. I mean, we, European Union, does have a multifaceted approach to China. We simultaneously see it as a partner, as an economic rival, and also as a systemic rival. And this is very similar to the essence of the US's own approach towards China, which seeks to compete with confidence, cooperate wherever the US can, and contest where it must. So, and also I think there's sometimes a little bit of a misconception on the trade side. You mentioned that our economy is deeply integrated with China. I think in some ways our economy and trade with China is large. I mean, it's over 2 billion euros a day, but sometimes we forget how much trade and investment there is between the US and China as well. And, you know, many of the products that we use every day, like Apple iPhones, are in fact assembled mainly in China, for example. So I think we both obviously clearly face challenges in our relationship with China. We're also concerned about issues in China, whether it's human rights in Xinjiang, the belligerency we've seen across the Taiwan Strait. An issue which we increasingly is a problem for us is trying to address an economic level playing field, concerns that we have with China. We haven't made significant progress. We have a massive trade deficit. Like the Americans, we're also concerned about the theft of intellectual property and being able to compete in a fair way. Also, I think, which is really an issue for us, is how we see the scale of China's diplomatic and economic support for Russia's invasion of Ukraine. While we haven't seen any weapons being shipped from China to Russia, you know, the Chinese companies are playing a role in rebuilding Russia's military industrial base with dual-use goods, you know, which are being used in drones and semiconductors. This is undermining the effectiveness of the sanctions that we have on Russia. And this is, of course, something where we are engaging with China in very closely. So we're very much talking to China about the role it's playing in Russia. But, you know, on the other hand, we also have issues like climate change, where, you know, European Union has made a lot of progress in reducing its own emissions. But, you know, to make a difference, which is important globally, but also others need to do the same as well. And we have to keep talking closely with the Chinese on this. So, you know, to sum up, we're doing a lot of work on the trade and economic security side. We're continuing to engage with China. We're developing our own toolbox. We had the consultations between the US and the EU on China in the Indo-Pacific here in Washington, D.C. last week. And I think we're very much on the same page as the Americans in terms of our analysis. Our situations do differ slightly. Also, the ways our decision-making is done differs as well. So we're not always going to do exactly the same as the Americans and vice versa, but it's very important that we do talk to one another to compare notes. And there are areas in which we are working together as well with regard to China and the broader region.
So within what you can disclose, how would the EU best prepare itself in the eventuality that push does come to shove between the US and China if tensions were to rise?
Well, I think it's far from a foregone conclusion that these US-Chinese tensions will automatically increase. I know the US government is working very hard on keeping communications open with China, especially also in military-to-military dialogue. We've seen some sort of stabilization in the relationship with the meeting between President Xi and Biden in San Francisco last year. Has also welcomed the fact that there was no immediate increase in the tension across the Taiwan Strait ahead or immediately after the elections in Taiwan. Of course, while we continue to watch that situation very clearly, especially ahead of the inauguration, there's perhaps some grounds for optimism, but certainly, of course, no grounds for complacency either. I think what we need to do as a European Union, in direct response to your question, is to continue our own diplomacy and maintain our close contacts with Washington and Beijing. We have a huge stake in terms of economic and security, having a free and open Indo-Pacific, not least because of our own trade with Asia, but because, of course, we've seen how security threats can have a global dimension. So, you know, what happens in the Indo-Pacific is of real concern to the EU. So maintaining these open levels of communication is important. We engage also with the region. It's not just with the US and China. So, you know, it's something we continue to work on. And, you know, we'll see how things go.
We'll be wrapping up here in a second. Before we do, I was wondering if there were any insights that you could provide, perhaps to European citizens who are looking to work in the US or perhaps engage with the US, and then perhaps any insights that you have for our American listeners who want to engage more with the EU and Europe in general.
Yeah, thanks for the question. So maybe to students, we do run an intern program here in the delegation, and we're always welcome European and American interns here. We do two intakes a year, each of 5 months. We take between 7 and 10 interns for each intake. We also run a series of public diplomacy programs, also people-to-people programs as well. Perhaps rather than go through them all, you know, I can refer you to the European Union delegation website here in Washington, D.C. But one thing which might be of interest to you is we engage with American colleges and universities in what we call the Schuman Challenge, which is a foreign policy debating competition. It's too late to enter for this year, but we'll be having the finals here in the delegation at the beginning of April. So I would encourage anyone to engage with American society, Americans to engage with Europeans, Europeans to come to America. Fantastic country here in the US and fantastic countries in the EU as well. Very diverse, you know, historically, culturally. I think the more people travel, the more people talk to one another, I think that increases the scope for understanding and comprehension. And we do our own little part. It's modest here in the delegation to encourage that, especially amongst young people.
Deputy Ambassador Curtis, thank you so much for your time and for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
For all of our listeners out there, Small World, Big Problems is a student-led production sponsored by the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies at Johns Hopkins University's Paul H. Nitzer School of Advanced International Studies, located in Washington, D.C. Small World, Big Problems can be found on Spotify, Apple, Amazon, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to become a part of the podcast, suggest a guest for the show, or just send us your feedback, please email us at sicestrategypodcast@gmail.com. This episode was researched by Juliette Verlac, Ryan Sheets, and Camilla Manning, and edited and produced by Ryan Sheets. Many thanks to the team at the EU delegation in Washington, D.C. for helping to make this episode possible. I'm Milos Maggiore. We will be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. Take care and see you all soon.